Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 22nd of June, a cover story, The Eight Wonders of the Human Brain. The more we learn about our command centre, the more mysteries arise. New Scientist goes in search of the biggest, presumably the eight of them. Inside your head is an object capable of feats of computation, creativity and understanding unrivaled in the known universe, and all using the power of a 20-watt light bulb. We've made huge strides in understanding the human brain. In recent years, we've discovered that brain cells can regenerate and pin down what happened when you start talking before you know what you want to say. Yet, the more we learn, the more we realise that we still don't know what we still don't know. In the following pages, we explore the biggest questions about the brain to reveal the mechanisms and mysteries of this phenomenal blob of grey goo. Now, these are pretty grey and gooey. When they dissect it and put it in your hands, they have to actually fill it with some sort of filler. What makes our brains special is presumably the first one. The human brain, we love to tell ourselves, is exceptional. Other animals might use tools or solve mazes, but can they invent computers or write sonnets? Yet, even with our extraordinary mental prowess, it isn't easy to explain what makes the human brain so special. At around 1.5 kilograms, our brains are about a third the weight of an elephant and a fifth of that of a sperm whale. If body sizes are taken into account, however, our brains are unusually large, between 7 and 8 times what would be expected from a mammal of our size. But this crude measure isn't enough to explain our intelligence. Brain to body size ratio of a Capuchin monkey is higher than that of a gorilla, yet gorillas are considered smarter. Clearly, size isn't everything. A more important metric might be the number of neurons, the brain's processing units. Humans have about 86 billion, according to Susan Herkuhuzers of Vanderbilt University, Tennessee, who's pioneered methods to count them. In fact, primate brains have more neurons than other mammal brains of comparable sizes. Humans, having the largest brains of any primate, also have the most neurons of any primate, and probably of any animal. This has possibly enabled the invention of cooking, which released more calories from food to fuel this energetically expensive organ. It isn't only a number of neurons that matters, but it's also where they are. Our remarkable abilities probably stem from having more neurons in our cerebral cortex, the brain's wrinkly outermost layer, than other animals, says Herkuhuzers. The structure allows us to develop more complex behaviours rather than simply responding to stimuli. Quote, if you have a cortex, you are no longer a slave to what happens to you. You have the flexibility to choose to do things otherwise, says Herkuhuzers. What's more, her team recently discovered that across warm-blooded animals, the number of neurons in the cortex correlates with longevity. Herkuhuzers thinks this is also a factor in our cognitive superiority. Humans take years to reach maturity. We take a long time to put that brain together, she says. All the while, you're assimilating information from the world. Neurons aren't the whole story. Cells called astrocytes, whose stars, play an important part in the role of intelligence. What makes the brain, page 14? So astrocytes are those star-shaped structural elements, so I'll have to read what's really interesting. But the sheer computing power afforded by 16 billion caudal... The caudal compacts. It's likely to be the critical factor behind our cognitive thing. Hello, Lily.
Hello.
Our cognitive dominance. It's a picture. Okay, here's the next question, I suppose. What is consciousness? I keep on going here. Think of consciousness mind as a furnace. If you are deeply asleep, the flame of consciousness has died down, but at a low, persistent level. In REM sleep, when you dream, the flame is jumping and burning brightly, but erratically. In a coma, it's a glowing ember. Consciousness, in other words, exists in a range of states. One explanation is that for full consciousness erupts in many parts of the brain, broadcasts information into a network of neurons known as the global workspace. When the broadcast doesn't take place, sensations remain subconscious. When the broadcast is incomplete, you get different levels of consciousness. But such as when you are dreaming or have had a blow to the head. By studying these states, one we should one day be able to pinpoint the brain mechanism that gives rise to consciousness. So why then has explaining consciousness how a kilogram or so of nerve cells conjures up a swirl of thoughts and emotions that make up our mental experience be dubbed the hard problem? One reason is that philosophers have focused on explaining how we become aware of experiences. Their term qala describes the properties of experiences that have, such as the redness of a strawberry or the perception of a taste of wine. Trying to find explanation for qala has caused no end of confusion among neuroscientists. One solution to the problem is to ignore it. Qala is a term of art introduced by philosophers who want to make the question about nature and consciousness answerable only by spooky non-biological accounts. This is Patricia Churchland, the University of California, San Diego. After all, we don't normally talk about qala. We talk about things such as being tired, needing to eat, or even being in love. Feelings that have a straightforward, non-spooky biological origin. Many people aren't aware of the qala until they are prompted by philosophers, says Daniel Tennant of Tufts University in Massachusetts. I think that's a religious university, I think. Bennett not only thinks that there is no hard problem, he believes consciousness itself is a kind of illusion. Quote, it takes some kind of substantial coaxing and cajoling to get people to notice their qala, he says. And when they think they do notice them, they are falling into another illusion. The illusion, according to Dennett, is that each of us believes we have the privileged access to some remarkable properties of our own mental states, which we are. So I'll see you at. Good luck. Hope you enjoy wherever you're going. Okay. Acquainted. With which we are intimately acquainted and which we perceive as experience, but our brain presents to our consciousness only what matters to us. It does so in a way that we can understand. For example, it's why we see things as being a particular colour. The real world isn't like that. Our visual systems effectively colour code the world for us. To simplify it, illusions of the mind. Dennett argues that much of the colour is an illusion created by the brain. So too is consciousness, much as colour. Consciousness is a user illusion designed by evolution to make life easier for the brain that must guide a body through a perilous life, he says. Smartphone designers call the screen of the smartphone a user illusion. The screen is an interface to a computer underneath, but the icons on it, such as the envelope that depicts a message, are symbolic. They don't bear any relation to the actual hardware and software of the phone's messaging system. If our brain is a smartphone, consciousness is a screen, an interface to the brain. However, as Churchland says, the metaphor isn't exact. When we feel dizzy or pinpoint where a sound is coming from, for example, it's a result of physical processes in the brain. Perhaps consciousness is more like a smartphone screen that presents different apps according to the amount of battery left and how much it's taken. It has been shaken. Consciousness, in other words, is a partial illusion, a picture knitted together by the brain as a result of all the inputs receiving and the completeness of the brain broadcast. I just think that's just. Oh. A brain is a smartphone, consciousness is a screen, neural ripples. Gamma waves are one of the five types of brain waves, each oscillating at different frequencies and associated with a different task. And, the others are alpha, beta, delta and theta waves. When we consciously pay attention to something, what's going on in the brain? And that's a very interesting thing. I wish I might go back and read that neuroscience book. See if I get him. That was really a nothing question, nothing thing. Consciousness. Smarter people's brains difference. The short answer is yes. People vary in their intelligence. So how else could we account for this, if not this difference in the structure and function of the brain? Exactly what those differences are, however, is a matter of intense investigation. First thing is to note that people with larger brains really do tend to have a higher IQ, but there is more than that size. What makes our brain special, says page 34. To find out more, we need to zoom in on the white and grey matter that makes up our brain. The latter is comprised of the main bodies, the neurons, whereas the white matter is made of fibres known for which they send signals. Roger Kelvin of MC MRC, Cognition and Brain Sciences unit at Cambridge, UK, and its colleagues have found that the volume of grey matter in the frontal lobe, see the diagram right, is connected to the fluid intelligence, which is the ability to solve novel problems. They also found this is also linked to the amount of white matter connections between the two halves of the prefrontal parts of the brain. It isn't just the amount of tissue that counts. One of the most striking features of the mammalian brain is the way the deep folds of grey matter into the surface are giving a walnut appearance. These increase the surface area, bringing cells closer together and allowing them to communicate faster. And sure enough, the extent of folding is correlated with the speed of thought and working memory. Smarter people have more folded brains. But this doesn't tell us where the brain intelligence resides. To find this out, we can turn to one of the most popular ideas about its location, something called pietrofrontal integration theory. The purpose is a biological basis of intelligence is a network connecting different brains' hotspots. Clues about the hotspots can be found in the brain imaging studies by examining how parts of the brain became activated during cognitive tasks. Uri Bautzen at Goethe University Frankfurt in Germany and her colleagues identified a network connecting 20 different areas of the frontal and preparietal regions that are associated with intelligence. People with more grey matter or higher neural activity in these regions were smarter. It feels like we are getting somewhere, but it doesn't mean that we're smarter people have physically different brains. They seem to have ones that work more efficiently too. The brain might have the right chassis for high performance, says Emilio Strachore of Harvard Medical School. Quote, but it's not that relevant without an onboard computer regulating how the power is delivered and when to allocate resources in a given moment. Santucci's work suggests that intelligence can be boosted by magnetic stimulation to increase the brain's processing efficiency. He also emphasizes the importance of plasticity and the ability to change. Perhaps people's brains are inherently more plastic, more capable of learning. That is to say nothing of genetics. Although we know hundreds of genes contribute to intelligence, it is going to take a long time to discover the nuances of their impact. But then, it's never going to be a simple matter to find the location of intelligence. The richest human trait in the brain, the most complex known object in the universe, oh, like vomit. What happens when we think? These are just such a bland poem. Thinking about thinking, it doesn't take you long for your mind to go down a rabbit hole. Thoughts that naturally come to us, but pinning down exactly what they are more complicated. Once they were viewed as immaterial entities separated from biological matter of the brain. Now we know that every thought, whether about a simple object or an abstract idea, is a result of electrical signals pulsing through the brain's network of 86 billion neurons. Quote, for me, a thought is simply the transformation of inputs and outputs by the brain, says Ethan Solomon of the University of Pennsylvania. But if you ask 100 neuroscientists for a definition, you will get 100 different answers, says Augustus Sherlock of the University of California, Berkeley. Quote, it's thinking, thinking is an umbrella term which covers a multiple different cognitive processes, she said. Some thoughts take the form of pictures, where others are comprised of words, and many take place at this unconscious level without even noticing. The latest neurological studies tell us, let us tune into electrical signals that underline thinking. They show that even basic... Gee, I'm just really disappointed with this article, between you and me. Thought involves a surprising amount of activity, with different brain areas firing up and sending information to other, and certain hub regions directing traffic. Last year, for example, Sherrod and her colleagues recorded a journey of an individual thought in the brain by measuring the electrical signals involved when people were asked to recall and say a word. The first areas to show activities were the visual and auditory cortex to receive the signals from the eyes and the ears. Next, the brain's command center, the prefrontal cortex, kicked in. The harder memory tasks, the more prefrontal cortex became activated, and the longer it took to respond, reflecting the time taken for the region to recruit other brain areas, such as networks where the memories are stored. Finally, the motor cortex revved to generate the spoken response. Surprisingly, this happened before the prefrontal cortex had decided on the response. That's why sometimes we start speaking before we know what we want to say, says Shirotu. So, the prefrontal cortex helps orchestrate the process, the thought process, but the signals involved also need to be coordinated. That's the job of the brain waves, the ripples and neural activities oscillating at different frequencies across the brain. So lots of research reveals that during memory tests, the low-frequency theta waves in the various brain regions involved become coordinated. And this synchronization possibly allows information to become integrated between the regions. Our newfound ability to eavesdrop on the individual thoughts means that mind-reading devices are no longer just the stuff of fiction. Earlier this year, electrodes in the brain were used to translate brainwaves into words and spoken by a computer. Techniques like these could help people with locked-in syndromes, who are conscious but unable to move or to communicate, all thanks to the power of thought. The next thing, are you thinking what I'm thinking? Mind-reading devices are no longer the stuff of whatever it is, science fiction. Sort of a bad thing. Are you really left or right brained? Chances are you thought of yourself as left or right brained, rational, logical, creative, and free spirited. Appealing as this concept is, it's also a complete myth. It's easy to see how the ideas was born. In the 1960s, we discovered that certain functions occur solely on one side of the brain. Most people process language on the left hemisphere, whereas our emotions are dealt with on the right. It was soon said that our left hemisphere held a monopoly over the virtues of logic, reason, and language. The right side of the brain was responsible for driving our emotions, masculinity, impulsiveness, and musicality and impulsiveness. From this came the popular maxim that whichever side of your brain dominated determined your personality. The truth is more nuanced. For instance, although your left hemisphere produces complex speech, the right allows you to understand the emotional metaphorical content of the words. It gives you some linguistic finesse. Creative thought, on the other hand, activates a widespread network of cells that favour neither hemisphere. Moreover, there is no evidence that one side of the brain dominates. Jeffrey Anderson of University of Utah has scanned the brains of more than 1,000 people while they performed various tasks and showed that none of them feel autonomous for one using one side of the brain over the other. Top to bottom, other ideas abound. Quote, the theory of cognitive modes developed by Stephen Kosslyn for Harvard University holds that our cognitive style is determined by whether we are on top or bottom brain. The top regions of our brain are involved in formulating, carrying out plans, and revising them as we go. The lower regions are largely concerned with processing inputs and sensors, classifying objects and events, and giving them meaning. Everyone uses the brain all of the time, says Kosslyn, but each of us, to some extent, relies more on top or bottom systems. And this affects our behaviour. A top brain-dominated person, for instance, will be more and more creative go-getter, but sometimes ineffective because they don't update plans based on current. Oh dear, top and bottom brain. God. Left and right's not good. On circumstances, bottom brain types think through the details and plan and are less likely to be initiate complex schemes. Anderson, however, points out that our personalities probably arise from the way various brain systems are connected and how rich those things are. For instance, people who are open to new experiences are more likely to get goosebumps when they see a beautiful sunset. Brain scans show that they have more connections between areas that process sensory information and regions responsible for the inner voice. We can feed this information into deep learning machines and make accurate predictions about personality traits based on the person's brain scan, says Anderson. It's not about anyone using the left or right side of the brain anymore. He says it's about subtle differences in connections across the whole brain. Is your brain ever off? When you're at rest, it sometimes feels as your brain switches off too. It doesn't. If you are alive, your neurons are firing. There are a lot of processing going on, even when you're not seemingly doing anything at all, says Denise Van Chesterbeer, a cognitive neuroscientist at the Fudan University of China. He could hardly be more any other way. Moment-to-moment readiness was a matter of life and death of our ancestors. These days, most of us don't have to worry about leopards leaping from the undergrowth, but we still need, well, we never had to in Australia. But we still need to be alert to the dangers of opportunity, so it requires the brain that is working constantly. Back in the 1990s, neuroscientists noticed that people lying quietly in a brain scanners with their eyes closed showed a surprisingly level of brain activity. Researchers soon mapped the brain regions that are most active during rest. This is because this became known as the default mode network. This shows little activity when we are engaged in tasks requiring attention, but fires up when we are switched off and allowing our minds to wander. Some evidence suggests that the default mode networks is involved in mulling over past experiences and speculating about future. In that sense, it is vital because daydreaming is considered to be one of our abilities that sets us apart from other animals. But the default mode network does come more than that. But the default mode network does more than that. In 2017, Van Esve and his colleagues demonstrated that underlying our abilities to do certain things without paying attention, such as trying our shoelaces and driving along a familiar route out of our autopilot mode, shutting down. The brain is a hyper activity during sleep too. Once consciousness is lost, it gets to work on all matters of chores, clearing up toxic molecules, regulating hormone levels, and conjuring dreams, which are thought to be provide safe environments to simulate new behaviors that could be during the waking life. Sleeping brain also files away experiences for later recall. Even when somebody is in a vegetative state, unconscious, apparent, unresponsive for a prolonged period, their brain continues to work at some level. When some people in the state are asked to imagine themselves playing tennis, for instance, blood flow increases to the brain regions associated with motor skills, suggesting that neurons here are firing. In one case, a patient similarly activated those regions on command in his response to a yes-no question. Only when you die do your neurons shut down completely. Except even then, there is a final burst of activity. So it's Jess Hard in the University of Cincinnati, Idaho, and his colleagues recently showed, for the first time in humans, when the heart is in the look of pumping blood to the brain, starving it of oxygen, neurons draw on the energy reserves and continue for firing up to 3 minutes before they produce one last burst of electrochemical energy. Only then does the brain switch off for good. Well, there you go. So you've got 3 minutes before your brain gets switches off for good. It's that last burst. 22. I'm just checking the time here. Coming to 2, I'll have to stop and do some something. Does the gut influence the mind? We often say we make decisions based on gut feelings, and this may be truer than we realise. Nausea, for instance, makes us judge certain moral violations more harshly. This is just one of the many ways our gut influences what's going on in our head. It's easy to forget that our gut, in a sense, is a sense organ detecting incoming nutrients, toxins, pathogens, and relaying information to our brain. It contains 50 million neurons that coordinate the processes of digestion. The gut is home to 2 kilograms of bacteria, a biome which influences every organ in the body, including the brain. A wealth of studies in mice show that changing bacteria in the gut can change the behaviour, in some cases turning animals into antisocial learners. The biome may be particularly important in childhood. While the brain is still developing, mice that lack biomes called bifidobacteria in their gut during infancy seem worse at learning new information, for example. Evidence from humans is accumulating too. The imaging study found that consuming a fermented milk drink containing various strains of live bacteria had a profound effect on people's rest and brain activity and their responses to a series of seeing faces showing emotion. This year, a study of 1,054 people in Belgium found that certain types of gut bacteria are less prevalent than people with depression.
I don't know what you think that means.
It is also a tantalizing hint that certain neurological conditions such as autism and diseases such as Alzheimer's may originate in the gut. Parkinson's silken fibers, a hallmark of the disease, seem to appear first in the gut before spreading to the brain. We don't know what triggers it, but it could be known as a microbe or toxin. In epilepsies, changes in the microbiome may be at what the high-fat keto diet prevents seizures in some people. Research on gut-brain connection from its infancy, but it has sparked the idea of medicines that target the microbiome to improve our mental health, dubbed psychobiotics. John Crane of the University College of Cork Island believes it is an exciting prospect, but a lot more work is needed to pinpoint which bacteria are beneficial for which condition and how to deliver them to the gut. How bacteria actually influence the brain is becoming a mystery. It's something of a mystery, but the picture is becoming clearer. Tens of trillions of bacteria in our gut are a hive of metabolic activity, producing a wealth of chemicals that we can absorb. Working out which one gets to the brain and exerts effects on the big focus of the current research. Some bacteria even feed on GABA, the brain's chemical implicated on depression. It might seem odd that our brains are influenced by our guts, but it isn't so surprising when you consider that microbes have always been with us, says Crayon. Quote, it seems... I see them as friends with social benefits because they really affect the social brain in the early life of development, he says. The relationship is very important, and I think it's been evolutionally wired. Continuing reading, what makes the brain? A few years ago, scientists took human brain cells and injected them into mice. A year later, the cells had multiplied and the mice had got smarter, learning more effectively than mice with regular brains. Perhaps it isn't so surprising until you hear about these brain cells weren't neurons. As building blocks that the brain goes, neurons hog the attention. There are some 86 billion of these stringy cells, that's a good way of describing, carrying chemical electrical impulses around the brain, helping us to control our bodies and think thoughts. But there are plenty of cells in the brain that aren't electrically active. These cells are known as glial cells. Now, G-L-I-A-L cells. They're at least as numerous as neurons. A type of glial cell called the astrocyte was injected into the mouse brain, suggesting not for the first time that could be important in learning. Glia is used to be considered one of the gap fillers, so they support, but they actually tend and nurture the cells. No longer, there's a lot of evidence to say they're more than just glue, says Anne Cook, Chief Executive of the British Neuroscience Association. They are the unsung heroes of the brain. There are some different types. The small ones called microglia, for instance, roam the brain, gobbling up foreign materials to protect the neurons. Gee whiz, that's it. Now remember those. Astrocytes are neurons, take care of neurons too, controlling levels of chemical messages known as neurotransmitters and helping repair damage. Evidence is mounting that these cells also have a role in the development of human intelligence. We know that babies start off with the many connections between the neurons, and these are gradually pruned down to create a smaller number of stronger signaling pathways. Astrocytes, which are star states, as my point, it seems, are involved in pruning. While neurons are still very important, it seems that glial cells are involved in setting the gain on the system, says Edelin, the Allen Institute of Brain Science in Seattle. Isn't it all about cells? Holes play a part too. Deep inside your head, there are slim chambers called ventricles that produce the fluid that bathes the cells in your brain. We take as much as 500 milliliters of the cerebrinal fluid daily, which keeps everything in working order, providing cushioning and nutrients and washing waste away. There's no doubt there's more to be discovered. During the last year, I really want to read all about this, researchers identified a new type of brain cell dubbed the rose hip neuron due to its resemblance to the shape of a rose bush fruit. It may only exist in humans. Its secrets may well be revealed in Leonard's ongoing efforts to create a map of the brain cells, painstakingly detective work that looks at the genes single cells express. He recently studied the neocortex, the outer part of the human brain, which deals with higher processes that make up 80% of its mass. and found around 75 different types of cells there alone. So what is a rosette one? What makes brains more resistant to decline? This may be the eighth fact, eighth wonder. Gee whiz, it's a bit boring. Sorry to do this for you. It's a harsh fact of life. As you get older, your cognitive abilities start to wane. But why is that some people reach a ripe old age with a little more than a senior moment, while others go into far greater decline? The brain starts shrinking around the age of 40, with cells deteriorating most quickly in the frontal lobe, the striatum and the hippocampus, areas involved in the most complex thoughts and movement and memory. How resistant you are to the effects of this decline is likely to be associated with the cognitive reserve. This is a kind of mental buffer that allows your brain to sustain more damage before you notice changes in your cognition. Cognitive reserve isn't just down to someone having more neurons than another person, but it's also how well these neurons engage with each other across different networks of the brain. This allows the brain to compensate when age-related decline occurs for a disease to take hold, and helps reroute the information so the organ can continue to work optimally. It's a bit like boosting the processor power of a computer. More things can go wrong before you start to notice it's slowing down. Our environment can also influence cognitive reserve. A high level of education offers one of the biggest boosts, whereas obesity and insulin resistance seem to reduce it. Several genes also help us resist cognitive decline. Tiny genetic variations are associated with our susceptibility to Alzheimer's, as well as with how the brain utilizes energy reserves and reacts to injury and pathogens. Exercise and main. Brain shrinkage over time sounds bleak, but there's some good news. Although most of our brain cells are created soon after birth, we can make certain types of neurons even into our 90s. This ability goes some way to explaining why people with brains are a fair better against the ravages of old age. There are a few other ways to boost cognitive reserve. Continue to educate yourself throughout your life appears to provide one of the biggest benefits. But playing a musical instrument, socialising, getting the right amounts of sleep, and speaking more than one language can also help. But don't put your feet up for long, though. The adage, the healthy body, healthy mind, turns out to be true. If you're looking to maintain brain health, you need to exercise, says Steve Hedrich, Director of Human and Applied Physiological Sciences in the King's College London. Regular workouts bring about significant improvements in memory, attention, processing speed, and executive functions such as planning and multitasking. Don't leave it too late. Richard Henderson of the University of Cambridge and his colleagues have discovered that things we do in midlife outside the work and education make a unique contribution to the brain healthier in older age. The activities of retirees in their old age, however, had less impact. Midlife seems a good time to intervene, to nudge people into taking part in more activities, physical, intellectual, social, that might bode well for them 20, 30 years later on, says Henderson. Okay, that's the brain one, and that's 32 minutes. I'll lock that off and do another one. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.